Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. Help find your own truth by exploring perspectives you won't find in the mainstream on some of life's biggest mysteries. Whether it's grand conspiracies, breakaway societies, UFOs, ancient civilizations, lost wisdom, as well as the paranormal, all at your fingertips. Stream videos anywhere from your living room or on the go with access to over 7,000 titles, all available to you with a monthly plan for only $9.95 a month. If you sign up now, the first month is only 99 cents. And there are multiple plans to choose from, including a three-month plan and an annual plan. If you enjoy expanding your perspective, then you'll enjoy Gaia.com. Gaia.com. G-A-I-A.com.
Well, howdy there, friends. Thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. I am Cam Hale. And as always, riding along with me on this wacky little fun bus is Mr. Philio, Kyle Filson. Philly, what are you doing over there?
Hey, brother. I am sitting here looking at two monitors, gloating in the fact that the Cubs won the first game with a solo home run. I'm sorry.
A holo-some run?
I said it backwards, right? I was very tense during that game because it was just such a good pitching battle. And I was like, oh, my God, can this please be over?
Well, I was in the movies last night, and it was late, and Kyle starts texting me, and I mean late, I mean like we went to the Late Show to watch The Magnificent Seven.
Because you were on a marathon. I know you were going to the movies, I didn't know you were going on a movie marathon.
That's true. We are recording this show a little earlier than normal, folks, so yeah. Last night, it started during the day, my wife and I go, all right, let's go watch a movie. You know, we both took off, said, let's go watch a movie. So we go watch The Girl on the Train. Well, when we're there getting tickets for The Girl on the Train, we're like, well, there's nobody at the house. Our kids are going to be gone. So, like, let's go ahead and watch Deepwater Horizon. So, we bought tickets for that. So, that was going to be it till we left Deepwater Horizon. And then we grabbed a little bite to eat there by the movies. We're like, well, let's go back and watch Magnificent Seven. So, we watched all three in one day.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I've watched three movies in a row at a movie theater since I was probably 13. So that's quite impressive. I don't know if we went after it. If I could sit still long enough. Like, I'm real antsy. Like, if a movie doesn't get to it, even in like an hour, I start like, all right, can this please just be over?
The first one was that way. It was a slow starter. I was having that feeling. But as we progressed, they just got wilder and wilder. And it was what was funny, though, in the late showing of Magnificent Seven, there was a couple in front of us with their three children.
And, oh, yeah, that's a great movie to take kids to.
Right. And two of their three children fell asleep. One of them was snoring so loud that the dad had to wake him up and be like, hey, man, there's people in here. I mean, he was just open mouthed. Just getting it on.
Who takes a bunch of kids to an 11 p.m. theater movie showing of The Magnificent Seven?
The only thing I'm assuming is they didn't have anybody to watch their children.
I understand that. Know, then you don't go to the movies.
That's what I told my wife. I go, then you stay home. Because you spent all that money to watch your kids take a nap.
Yeah.
I'm like, why don't you could have paid a sitter, you know? Or what? Or do like we always talk about doing. You lock them in the tub shed with some bottles of water and a jar of peanut butter. Yeah. They'll be fine when you
They'll
get
be
back.
Fine. Yeah.
There's something for them to eat, plenty of protein, something to drink, give them some coloring books. You'll be back in a few hours like you kennel your dog. So it'll be okay. The kids will be just fine.
You were showing me that picture not too long ago of a kid actually in a kennel with a red light on him.
Yeah. What was it? A brother had locked him in it. Yeah. One of the brothers had locked a kid in a dog kennel. I laughed so much at that. I can't help it. Because the minute I saw it, I thought of the boys. Because I'm like, that's something that one of the bros would do to the other one. But put him in a kennel where he couldn't get out and be like, sorry, when you get home, you have to tell Dad what you did.
Right.
I got something fun here, fellas. We're going to have, first of all, before we get started, we're going to have a fun show today. But before we get started, I hope everybody on the East Coast, all of our East Coast family, is safe and secure. It's horrible. The hurricane is whooping ass up and down that thing. So please, just get out of there. I mean, just get away from it. Just
you know where you need to move? Des Moines, Iowa.
It's not near as pretty as along the coast.
Well, yeah, but there's not storms that come in and flood your house every winter.
That's true. So just, folks, please be careful. We don't want to lose anybody.
For
Y'all
sure.
be very,
yeah,
very careful.
Sure. But I've Don't got, drown, turn around.
That's right. As he sips his coffee. I've got something odd here. This is really odd. This comes from the MUFON, okay? And I think you guys are going to enjoy this because we always talk about finding stuff on trail cams. Well, this is odd, guys. It says this photograph seems to show an anomalous object appearing and disappearing within a matter of seconds. It was discovered on Monday by an anonymous witness before being sent along to the MUFON, and the images were captured on a motion-triggered Moultrie trail camera.
Right.
And it says that the first few images taken by the camera that day showed nothing out of the ordinary. But then in one shot, some sort of strange mechanical apparatus seemed to have appeared out of nowhere. Yeah, what? That's right, folks. It captured a robot.
Are you serious?
If you look at this thing, man, I can't... First of all, I don't know what it would be just flying by the camera in time at this, but it almost looks like a large couch up on its edge, and it's got arms, and you can... But the couch, it doesn't look like furniture, but I mean, I'm just using that as a shape, yeah.
Dude, it kind of reminds me of what was the Flatwoods Monster.
Yeah.
In the 50s, remember that? Well, people described it as looking like a robot.
Yeah. Well, and even says, of course, the next picture was taken a few seconds later, and it's gone. So it's just not there, it's there, then it's gone.
I know what it is. It's a Terminator. Somebody sent it back through time.
And it caught it there. Good
and
call.
And it appeared, and then it went on its mission. So somewhere out there, it's chasing Sarah Connor or Cousins or somebody.
Right? It says, this is what the witness writes. This object is less than 200 feet from our house. We have nothing that would look like this thing on the back. I'm sending two pictures taken in the same minute. The first shows it is there. The second shows it is gone. But it says it didn't end there. Around 7 hours later, another image from the camera, it managed to pick up another anomaly. But this time, it was a metallic object in the sky. Yeah. It says also attached is a picture of an item in the sky too big to be a bird and not the shape of anything I have ever seen in the sky. This is still the witness. The witness writes, it is here, again, there, and then gone in about the same minute. Says the item in the sky is also to the right, maybe 35 degrees, and it's a big black object. So you can look in there. So in the same day, they have a robot, and then they have this strange object in the sky. First of all, look, I can go with the whole thing with the sky, but you can't explain this robot. I mean, where does this... And it's not like it's...
You think it was staged?
It almost looks like it does. It really, when you look at the photograph, it does almost look like it's staged. Because what it looks like, there's a little planter. You can see a row of utility poles with power lines, okay?
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. Yeah,
and you see the wheelbarrow, and then you see this robot, for a lack of a better term, I guess you could say robot. But if you look, it doesn't look like the wind's blowing. So it's not like it's blowing trash and stuff across, and this thing just blew up there. I really have no explanation. There's no way to rationally explain what that could be. You could be like, well, is it part of something? Is it in between? You know, because the way the picture looks, it looks like it's on the backside of this planter box. Right, but maybe it's in between it and the planter box, and maybe it's just something small.
That's what I'm thinking.
I don't know, but either way, it's fascinating. And the idea of there being an elusive bender robot from Futurama running around out in the woods is awesome.
That is crazy. Well, check this out. This is a pretty interesting article over on IO9. It's pretty neat. It's about the true scale of nuclear bombs is totally frightening. And I didn't even know this. It goes on to talk about how nuclear weapons are already scary enough, but when you dig deeper and find out how powerful the weapons truly are, they get even more terrifying. It goes on to say that these weapons we've built after the first atomic bombs are so strong that you can basically use Hiroshima as a unit of measurement. The largest nuclear explosion in human history, the Tsar Bomba, detonated with a force of 50 megatons or the power of 3,333 Hiroshimas.
That sounds so not cool.
The Russians had another bomb planned that would have even doubled that force at 100 megatons or 6,666 times the force of Hiroshima, but luckily they never tested it. They said the Tsar Bomba was already as scarily powerful as it can get since it almost destroyed the plane that dropped it and shattered windows as far away as Norway and Finland. They said even something like the B-83 bomb, which is the largest nuke in the U.S. arsenal, explodes with a mushroom cloud taller than where commercial airlines fly. The true scale of nuclear weapons is really something. So that really is scary. I mean, I guess this is something we take for granted. I never really think about how powerful these nuclear bombs are. And when you're talking about the Cold War or, you know, these threats that, oh, man, it could start a chain reaction of a nuclear war, World War III, and it would be the destruction of the whole planet.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm constantly thinking in terms of Hiroshima and Nagasaki because that's the only thing you've really seen, and that's the only time an actual nuclear weapon's ever been used on humans. But when you think about it, they're talking about, dude, that was like the first step. We've progressed so far past that the nuclear bombs of today are like that, 3,000 times more powerful than that. Can you imagine something like that, a war like that. I mean, even in, we brought it up earlier in the show with the Terminator, even the war that they show in that movie isn't even close to what would actually happen.
Yeah.
I mean, this thing could hit, you know, Houston, and we might be in trouble here. I mean,
these things, it's
incredible. And to think that we have thousands of those all over.
Yes.
And you know, all these reports of these UFOs coming and checking out what we're doing here and in Russia and everywhere. Maybe they really are. Like they must be wondering, like, what are these people doing?
Well, I think of it this way, whenever you're talking about it, is Hiroshima as a unit of measure is perfect way of thinking about it, because you're right. As I get lost in the same thing, is because that's the only thing we have to weigh it against. And you have to think of this. The very first automobile, think of the Model A.
Yeah.
And then park the Tesla beside it.
Yeah. I like the Fisker better than the Tesla, but
that just, they look a little cooler.
Right.
That's the only difference, is we don't have an overall or a view of, it's not like we've seen them used yearly so we can see the change like
exactly.
we do in vehicles.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
So we're still stuck in that antiquated idea, but that's the difference. That's the analogy, a Model A to the Tesla right now. That's the complete difference of what it's like, is it's 300,000 times difference, or 30,000 or whatever. It's no,
the B-83 is 6,666 times more powerful than Hiroshima.
I can't even, that's like telling me that that they're finding, like we talk about, ancient relics from 250,000 years ago. That number's made up to me.
You can't wrap your mind around it. No, because you can't visualize anything on that scale.
No, I'm good about 5,000 years. I can visualize about 5,000 years. I mean, even thinking back, like we always talk about, to the last ice age, the end of it. That's a stretch for me. I mean, it's hard. So you telling me that it's over 3,000 times, you know, more powerful. You're just like, you can't even wrap your head around what that would do if it landed, if it hit Oklahoma City, what it would do down here.
Oh, everywhere. And so now this is bringing up, you know, like people are always talking about disarming North Korea and they're trying to get nuclear power. I'm always like, oh yeah, it's a joke, you know, it's not going to do it. But now when I, you know, read this article, I'm like, man, you know, that is kind of frightening. No wonder we're always so dead set on stopping these countries from getting
it's something I wish
power.
We could undo.
It really is.
Yeah.
And you know, they always talk about, well, maybe one day there'll be peace and we'll all disarm. That'll never happen, because no one wants to take the chance of, okay, we mutually agree to disarm, and then guess what? Well, really,
one of us
didn't.
It's behind the house.
Yeah right.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're right. I mean, now that it's invented, it's out, it's never gonna be, it's, the world is never gonna not have them. And that's a scary thought, because it only takes one maniac.
Exactly. And we can't agree. There's never going to be peace. We can't even agree on what's better, mustard, mayonnaise, or ketchup. You can't even agree on
it's
that.
It's nice to think about. It's nice to, like John Lennon, to write these songs about peace and stuff. It's never going to happen. Human beings are terrible. We're never going to stop fighting. You can even look at just little children.
Yeah.
They're always fighting.
The human race is built on a history of war.
Yeah, that's all.
That's it. That's what it's built on. I know you've seen this, Kyle, and folks, I'm sure a majority of y'all have seen this. You've sent it to me. I've got a bunch of messages about it, links sent to me, and it was something that a friend of the show actually called me when they first saw this a while back and was like, have you checked this out? Folks, of course, this comes from the Daily Mail, so take it for what you will, but it's still interesting right here, folks. It's the Bigfoot that's been seen under the live eagle cam, under the nest of baby bald eagles.
Yeah, I saw a picture of this. It looks like a shadow to me. But
what it looks like to me is a bear, is what it looks like. But I'm going to read you this article. It says, two baby bald eagles were the stars of a Michigan live cam until Bigfoot allegedly walked into the frame. And it goes on to talk about what they have seen. And you can go and pull this video up, folks. You can look. But it says, the large figure pauses for a second and looks around before it begins to walk again. Two big feet clearly captured on the camera. It makes its way through the trees and then appears to jump over a branch and down a slope, landing a few feet below before disappearing into the shadows. It says the footage, believed to be filmed in the spring, was recently spotted by Carbon Media Group, which partnered with the Department of Natural Resources to install the camera. And then it was posted on YouTube, where many commenters claimed it was simply just a human playing a prank in an ape suit. But others believe that the figure's agility was a clear sign it was Bigfoot in the flesh. Now, this one person commented, Bigfoot for sure. A faker wouldn't jump down into the gully with the big ape suit on. It would take an easier path. And then there was another comment that says, I find this video intriguing. Either it's some jerk acting or it's the real deal. It goes on to write, the arms looked long and seemed to make it an athletic move by jumping on a tree branch, then leaped a few feet to the ground. Now, here's what's really interesting. Jeff Meldrum got involved. And for those of you that don't know, of course, he's the Idaho State University professor that does all the studies in Bigfoot and its feet.
He's going to be here soon.
He's going to be, this coming week. This coming weekend, he's going to be...
Jefferson,
yeah, speaking up there at the Bigfoot Conference. The Detroit Free Press actually interviewed Jeff about this, and he said it's an interesting video, but it remains just that, given the lack of scale and detail in the image. And I agree with him on that. It does. Now, look, it is very athletic and agile, the way it moves in this video. I know that a bear more than likely cannot move the way this thing is moving.
Right.
There's so many. I mean, what I don't know is maybe it was a guy just out there hiking. Maybe it's, you know, it looks black and creature.
It's not real clear, the photograph unfortunately, I would accept that in 1969, but this is 2016.
Yeah.
There's no excuse not to have HD 4K video. And when you see something this bad, to me, it screams of being staged or it's not what it is. You know what? I hate to be that person because it very well could be a Sasquatch that's been captured, but you'll never know because it just looks like a dark, shadowy thing moving.
Well, the difference is the camera's trained on the eagles.
Right.
That's what it's there for.
I understand that.
You know, and the focal point is completely different. So it's all down in there.
What do they call it? Blob squatch.
Blob squatch. Yeah, and I'm like what Mitch Hedberg says is blob squatch. He doesn't look blurry. That's just how he looks time. Yeah. He's just a blurry animal. You know what? I'm with you, though. I wish it was a little more clear. I see what Jeff Meldrum does is it's very interesting. And it's a good way to stay without committing yourself to it. But when you do look at the video, it is very interesting when
you
see that because you're like, man, what moves like that?
I want it to be real.
Yes.
I mean, I want to see an actual video of Sasquatch, and this very well might be that.
This may be the new Patterson-Gimlin, but we just can't.
But I can't say for sure what that is.
It's a blob squatch.
Yeah, very interesting, though.
Folks, I urge you to check it out. Like I said, you can get on YouTube, pull this picture up, this video up, Bigfoot sighting on Michigan Live Eagle Cam. Pull it up, watch that. Let's hear what you think. I mean, it's definitely an interesting video. And there's something else that I've got interesting I'm going to come back after break with, folks. We've talked about a few of these odd, I guess you could say, crashes. Much like Roswell, these interactions with UFOs that we've never really heard about, but crashes, you know, where they've hit the ground, people have seen it, they've had this interaction from around the world. We're going to talk about a few of those after the break, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. And we are back from the break and ready to have a little fun here. We're going to discuss this. I'm going to discuss this with my partner in crime over here.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to start be picking his brain as we start going down through here. I'm going to put him on the spot. Kyle, Roswell.
Yes, sir.
When did it all go down?
July 7th, 1947.
So I'm going to start around that time, actually a little bit later. I'm going to start on July in 1959 is when we're going to pick this little jewel up, okay?
Okay.
This is going to take place in an archipelago in Indonesia.
Ooh.
The Alor Islands, to be exact. It happened back in July. Now, there's a residence of these. Of course, you know, you got to imagine in 1959, it was a while back. We got to imagine that these are, I wouldn't say primitive people, but more of a natives people that live in these little island chain, right?
Yeah, especially in Indonesia at that time.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, they had actually reported to some people there, and I'm not really sure how the report got out, but they said that they encountered a group of six strangers on the east side of their island. They said what was odd is these strangers were about 6 feet tall, so larger than themselves, and they had a red hue to their skin and white wavy hair.
The Nordics.
Yeah, the first thing that jumped out to them, white wavy hair. He said, now they all wore these dark blue jumpsuits. They had long arms and high collars. Now, we've talked about this before, too, with these Nordics, right?
Yeah.
Said they had belts, and on their belts, there were cylinders hanging off of them that were gray in color, and that they did wear these boots, not like boots that they had ever seen. Later on, after the description, it was determined to be black military-style boots. And he said that these people that they encountered, this group of six strangers, seemed to be looking for something there on the island. Well, the islanders surrounded these folks, and then it said attacked them, started shooting them with arrows. Yeah, trying to defend their island against them. They said when the arrows were hitting them, it wasn't hurting them, didn't injure any of them. Now, they go on to state that 6 days after this initial encounter with these people, with these strangers, that there were some more reports of these strangers, except this time it was on the south side of the island, And it said that they were on this, what's called the Pantar Island. And that the same thing, they were looking for something. But this time it was reported by two people, a man and a six-year-old little boy. And it said that they had been abducted by these people. Well, the testimony given by the man said he was surrounded by these strangers who said they paralyzed him using those gray cylinders. They pulled him out, maced him with this alien paralyzing spray, the crazy purple knockout gas, and they put him down. And they said he couldn't understand their language, but he believed that he wanted that they wanted him to guide them. So he said, you know, that after a short time, I guess he couldn't really figure it out, they let him go. Later on, the child was found that they had taken, and he was just confused, completely unharmed. Well, the local police in this area, of course, it's on that island, they didn't really believe it. They thought it was something that was really, you know, no, that's not a real thing. You know, people are just kind of really blowing up this story. They may have run into somebody, and it got crazy. But the regional chief of police visited the site where this child had disappeared from, and it says there he and several other officers said they encountered these strangers and fired their weapons upon them, but never hit them, even though they were close range.
Well, that's weird, right?
Well, either they never hit them, or it just didn't do anything to them. And it says right after that that these strangers vanished about the time the shooting began. I said all they could find was footprints. So it's like they went invisible. They cloaked themselves, and then and they said they tracked them for about 15 foot into the woods, and then no more tracks.
Hmm.
So it's almost like you're like, what is? It makes me wonder. I'm like, is it? What's leaving these tracks? Are they holograms? What the heck's going on? So we're going to get into something even crazier, too. This happened in August of 1947. This took place on the Hay River in Canada. There was a Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer. He'd been a veteran of this area for quite some time. And he was head of these detachments in the Northwest Territory in northern Alberta along the Hay River there in 1947 in August. And the story goes that two fellows walked into his office. One was the commanding officer of the northern region, and the other was introduced to him as only by a fellow named Charlie. And Charlie was said to have been a part of the United States Air Force. And he had told this fellow that they were going to go on a top secret mission, and they were going to try to retrieve some things from two craft that was about 140 miles north of the Great Slave Lake. And that they had a Jeep with special tires, these large balloon tires, and that it was going to arrive the next day, and that he had to get gas and provisions that was going to supply them for a week. And it says that he goes on to state that he was told that he and the officer Charlie may have to walk the last 30 miles to even get into where they were going.
And jeez, he said 30 miles through
hike,
the snow.
Through the, well, it's in August, so I'm not sure how much. But still, you're talking about rough terrain. You're talking about hiking 30 miles, carrying gear, food. And then you don't know what you're going to be carrying out. So he swore, he's like, all right, don't mention this assignment. You got 7 years of secrecy is basically what they put on him. Don't talk about this for 7 years. Why seven? I don't know. That's a strange number. But that's
just like your credit, right? It goes away after
exactly.
7 years.
So apparently in 1954, he agreed. So he's like in 54, he started coming out talking about it. He said they started out, they moved, of course, down the bush roads onto the tundra and things. And he said the American had a map and that he was plotting out their course with something, he said, that looked way more advanced than a compass that he was using. So the Royal Canadian guy's like, I'm really not sure what he was really using. But he said that this fella plotted out two circles on the map. And he said that they were locations, of course, during their travels, of two UFOs.
Hmm.
Yeah. So they left at night, said they didn't want anybody to know, and said the instrument was designed to keep them on course within 2 degrees, is the way this story goes. So it was a very accurate little device.
Never heard of this story.
Says the train in that area, the terrain was real rough, and it said it kind of let them off course a little bit, and they had to back up. It said so they had to, you know, reverse their way. They kind of got around on a hill, couldn't get up in a certain spot, had to come back, get back on it. But it said that this Jeep that had all these big special tires would only do about 20 miles an hour, top speed. So they made pretty good time as they're just plodding along out of 140. You know, they're plodding down through there. It says that he began to using a slide ruler. He began to using the speedometer readings. The guy was really trying to figure this out. Because, I mean, you're talking about in the 40s. We're talking before there was anything.
The 50s, right?
Yeah, no. This was in 47 when this happened. Okay. He didn't tell his story till 54.
Oh, I got you. Right.
He didn't tell the story. In 47. So he said they made it to about 30 miles from the number one crash site is where they got to. He said 2 hours later, after they got into this area, he said they came across of this what he calls Arctic trees. It's real low scrub brush. So they went north about 5 miles of this Arctic tree line, and he said they came upon this very large object. is about 40 foot across, and he said it had a horseshoe shape cut out of the back end, and get a load of this, 6 exhaust pipes stuck out of it.
Really?
Yeah, so now it almost sounds like it's one of ours,
right? Yeah, man-made, right.
But he said he still described it in his stories as a huge saucer. So this large saucer, it makes me think of like a horseshoe crab without that hinged part. So it's gone. Yeah. It's just a crab shape with the cutout and then the exhaust. So he said it took 4 hours of them working on this craft. They were unbolting stuff, and they took some instruments from the inside. And it said the officer that was there, the U.S. Air Force guy, had to open up this steel flap with a key.
So he had a key for it.
That's what it's saying. He said inside the flap in black, he said there were letters. It said USAF.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it makes you start going, wait a minute. It's a test equipment.
Well, that's what they're talking about, these breakaway societies and stuff, is like if the U.S. Air Force was testing craft like that back in the 40s, can you imagine what they have now?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's what always makes me think, man. I really think that a lot of the UFO sightings is probably just top secret stuff.
Well, the reason I like this is because you start thinking about it's August of 47.
Right.
Roswell was July.
Yeah. Many people have theorized that.
You know, you start looking at it, you're like, what happened here? What's going on? Is it something we built that we got from the Germans?
Well, there's a lot of craft suspected UFO crashes that all happened in New Mexico. Well, that's exactly the same place we were testing all our top secret stuff at Los Alamos. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It is. It's something to really to keep an eye on. You know, you're like, yeah. What the heck's going on? Okay. So you got to imagine they do all that. They kind of sat down. They throw a little bivy camp right there. And they eat some dinner and all that stuff. They get up the next morning. They move another 20 miles. And they go across to the number 2 spot. So these crashed almost like they were flying in a pattern. One went down. Other one went down, right?
Yes, sir.
They move across to the number 2 spot. It's about 20 miles away. They do the exact same thing. They start removing equipment, stowing it in the Jeep. And then, of course, the Royal Canadian guy, he's like, boom, they drive off a bit, and they put an explosive in this craft. Yeah. He said they drive about 15 minutes away, and then it explodes.
So boom. They scuttled the craft.
They scuttled the craft, yeah. Now it says, of course, you know, to the number 1, that's the same. So they go to the, here's what's odd. Instead of blowing up the first one and then the second one, they blow up the second one, then they come back down into the first one, and then they blow that one up into pieces too, and then they return. And it says they return to Hay River, of course, on the 4th day. And this policeman said he was not allowed to take a camera, but that the U.S. officer that was there with him burned up a roll of film on each craft. Now, later on, the police officer there, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer there, he said he received a letter that just thanked him for his services. It says all he learned from this officer was that the two craft had been launched from a secret test field east of Los Angeles, and they were operated by remote control. It said that they could reach a speed of about 600 miles an hour, and they had enough fuel to last approximately 6 hours. He said the police officer went on to say that the flights had been recorded, and that's how they knew it precisely where to go when they went down.
Right, okay.
That they could know exactly where it was. Then the officer later told him, the guy that he was with, that he knew of the craft, but that the test was a second level of intelligence. That it seems that the test craft would be directed north into an area of a tundra for a softer landing, and that way it was far away from people. So if it went down, which... Okay, we're not talking worried about so much the soft landing, but we're talking about being directed far away from people, much like the deserts of New Mexico.
Yeah.
It's being directed far away from people. And then, of course, he's talked about, you know, that if any other thing would have been wrong, he could have lost them. They'd have landed in the ocean and stuff like that, you know, so that's the reason that they landed them that way. So it sounds, again, like, you know, these are encounters of some sort of craft crashing, but maybe it's not exactly what we thought. So you jump into January, the end of January of 1974 in North Wales. At 8:31 evening, there was a place, and I'm going to butcher this, in Wales. And I guess it's Clwyd. I don't really know how. It's C-L-W-Y-D. So I have no clue how you would probably go about pronouncing this. But in 1974, in that evening, they saw something fall from the sky. Dozens of people saw this thing fall out of the sky. The police officers and the office itself just was inundated with phone calls. So they were like, Before that, though, they found out that people were reporting seeing green lights over these mountains, this erratically moving green lights before they saw this thing fall down. So it goes on that they say that exactly 8:38, something crashed into the Berwyn Mountains there. And it said it was a measured on the Richter scale of a 4.5 tremor. Of whatever it was that hit.
Wow.
Yeah. So immediately, of course, police go crazy. They're like, what could that possibly be?
Right.
So they head to this mountain range, and they said what they expected to find was a passenger jet. They expected it was a large aircraft that had crashed, and, you know, you got to imagine what that's doing to you. You're like, there's going to be bodies everywhere. What are we going to do, you know, when we get there? We're just a small town police force.
Right.
In the 70s. But what they did find, they never told anybody. They said it was a convoy of army vehicles, large trucks, passed through the town of Chester that night and made its way to the crash site. It says then the army cordoned off the entire area, locked it completely down. It says even the police and local and area crash investigators were forced to leave. Like, get out of here.
Right. Okay.
Now, they said there was a nurse, and she reported that she lived near the scene there, and she had told the local newspaper that she had seen what she only described as a flying saucer, and that it actually hit the mountain and then threw debris, and she said bodies scattered out for over a mile. Now, she said she walked up to one of the bodies. She went out and got up there the minute the crash happened, and she said it was then when she realized that this body, to her, wasn't human. It wasn't a human body. But she said before she could describe what she had seen, the military got there and two Ministry of Defense officials got there, snagged her up, took her in a room, said, look, this is a threat to national security, what you're talking about. That's it. You're not to talk any more about it. So all she talked about was what she had seen and all this stuff. And then that's where it stops, is they were like, look, you can't be discussing this anymore. Now, it says that she had never been seen since in that area. Now, there were some news reporters that had visited the scene also. They refused to talk about it at all. Nothing. They were like, we're not saying a word about any of this stuff. So apparently they were visited. Now, they said there was an electronics engineer named Arthur Adams. And in 1980, he had worked on the Concorde, and he visited that site. And he did some investigating. And he claims that he found some green-colored pieces of metal stuck, like literally embedded in the rock in that area. And he says that he took samples and took them back to his lab. This is how the story goes. And that a 1-inch cube gave off 2 kilowatts of electricity when it was wired up to a voltmeter. Yeah. Now, of course, we don't really know about how this whole thing works, but the story goes on that they were going to publish a series of articles. He was going to publish some stuff about it, and the Ministry of Defense stopped that whole thing too and went and had a talk to him and said, that's it. No more.
That's very odd, right?
It is strange that it seems like they always know what hits. They always know where to go. They know where to clean it up. I like that one because it links in like with the American one that happened up in Canada. Is this thing crashed, but it's like before the police could even really get there and figure out what's going on, there's military presence is already there. It's like they were tracking it. They knew where it was going.
Sort of makes it seem like, right?
Yes. Timmendorfer, Germany, 1961 in February. There was a crash there near the Baltic Sea in 1961. There was photos of what was described as a 100-foot disc. Now, the British Army had a report, and they reported on this. Now, according to that report, they had set up a perimeter there in Germany, right?
Right.
And that it had landed in some very soft, what they described as loamy, so very airy soil near the Russian border. So it hadn't busted itself to pieces, but about a third of it was buried, so it just kind of slid in, dug in. You know, perfect soft landing. Story goes that the Russians and the Americans showed up very quickly because both sides had been tracking this thing. And they claim, and this is in the report, it claims this, that inside all the occupants were dead. There were 12 of them. And all 12 of them were very small, 3 to 4 foot in height. Yeah.
See, so that's the difference. We're talking about these crashes, and you're describing something that sounds much like something that's man-made. It's top secret stuff. But when you talk about crashes and finding
little bodies
with little bodies, that's totally different, right?
So, yes.
To me, there's two categories of these crashes.
They go on to describe these little creatures, these little men and women or whatever these small things were. They were short, gray. They said they had large heads, thin bodies, and large eyes. Now, the story says that there are pictures of these bodies that are being loaded onto stretchers and moved into these, like, military ambulances, basically.
Right.
To be moved out, boxed up and moved out. Now, there also claims to be, like, autopsy photos. You know how that stuff always goes down. And I've not been able to find that. You know, I've looked. You can't find anything like that. But there was some really neat stuff that goes in with this report, this story. is they claim that the men doing the autopsy said that there's no way these species were capable of reproduction.
Right, okay.
There's no reproduction. They also say that they don't believe that they could even process or ingest food the way we know of it. And to them, it looked like they were cookie-cutter clones.
Yeah, like worker bees.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I've heard of these, of the grays of being just that.
And it makes sense, right? It's just like, if you could build them something like that, like we discussed on the Dulce base, talking about the working caste and all that stuff, maybe that's what they are, is they're genetically engineered workers.
And even in the movie, like Fire in the Sky, about Travis Walton, you remember when he was in there? The gray like alien almost was like a suit, like something had clawed inside that and was wearing that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I don't, you know, it's really weird.
It is. Well, you're right. It's just, it's all, the whole thing is strange. Now, here's what's not strange about this story. It wraps up with the fact saying that the U.S. showed up and cut this craft into pieces and hauled it off.
Right.
You know, where they could actually move around with it. And it, the story ends up saying that it ended up on a little Air Force base there in Ohio, my friend. The Wright-Patterson.
Yeah, of course.
Which is no shocker.
Mecca.
There. Yeah, right?
For UFO debris.
That's where they drop it all off. Now, we're going to come back to the U.S. Now, we're talked about Roswell in 47. You know, we all know that. Everybody knows that one. There was one that happened in October of 47 in Arizona. Now, we've talked about some stuff being seen in Arizona before, and a guy witnessing, you know, stuff, you know, aliens working around outside of craft and all that. But there was a fella there named Selman Graves, and he was out with his brother-in-law, Bob. Now, Bob was 16. Selman's 22, of course, at the time. They were doing some small game hunting while they were running around out there near Cave Creek. So they were also exploring some old mines, you know, which I could only imagine growing up in mine country. I bet that'd be fun. I mean, I'm... Yeah. Digging there and seeing what you can get. Anyway, there's a big knob, a big hill out there. And he said, oh, let's climb up to it. You know, just being young men running around, having a good time. 47. So they climb up and they're just sitting on top of the hill, relaxing, looking around. Said they saw something that they didn't really expect. And also that they really couldn't wrap their head around. They said where they were at, it looked to be maybe a mile or less down in this valley. They noticed what Selman described as a metallic dome that was silver and very large, just sitting down there in the desert. Now, he said instantly he thought it was like an observatory dome or an observatory deck, like maybe something's down there, and they're just out there looking at the stars. You know, maybe it's somebody built something. But he said he couldn't understand why you would put anything, deal as far as an observatory, in the valley. Why wouldn't you put it up on top of a hill, right?
Yeah.
So that's when he got to noticing there were two trucks down there beside it and five men all monkeying around. He said he noticed there were no uniforms, but nobody was working. Now, of course, this is an estimation, but it's 30 foot or better. You know, he could, but he said, I'm guessing around 30 feet. Now, like we said, you know, he's close to a mile off. So you're like, and I'm sure if you're looking at the truck parked beside there, things like that, you're like, okay, you know, yeah, we're going with that. He didn't think anything of it. This is 1947. You know, he's just right. Like, ah, I guess somebody out there doing some work. You know, maybe that's what it is. He goes on to say that it wasn't until 1942 he came across a book about UFOs, you know, and I'm sure he had heard, you know, from Roswell and all. I'm sure he'd heard about it.
Yeah.
You know, but he said he never thought anything of it. He said he came across this book and he picks it up and he starts reading it. And he said what he thought was interesting of it was about what he called the Cave Creek incident. And he's like, what? Was I involved? I was here, you know. And in the book, it mentioned what was two humanoid bodies were said to be retrieved from the craft that he saw.
The dome thing he saw.
This dome thing he saw, yeah.
That's crazy.
Now, I can't find...
He was unaware of it until he read the book.
And I can't find that if it was just maybe an article in a book or maybe it was a book about it. I can't find exactly what book he was talking about. So, you know, this is... We really don't know this whole thing. But he said what it was believed that it had actually been... There were two crashes in around that same time around the Phoenix area, okay?
Okay.
That's what they believed. Now, they believed this, that it was actually only one craft. They said there's the Dreamy Draw area, and they believed that the UFO first touched down. They don't know if it crashed or it just bounced in or, you know, what it was, but it landed in that area. Then it picked back up and made it over to the Cave Creek area, I guess, for lack of a better term, before completely running out of fuel and then just ditched in hard. And then that's, of course, where the crash took place. And that's where he was. That's where Selman was whenever he saw it. Now, there's another story that goes along with it. Said there was a miner in that area there. And that he had come forward saying that he had watched what he said he believed to be some government agents that were working back in there that was recovering some wreckage of what he said looked like a flying saucer. This old fella's name was Pete. And he said that, and he talks about a book that he had actually looked into and some things like that. But, you know, we really don't know. But anyhow, the whole story still makes it look like the fact that Cave Creek was maybe like a little area, a little mining area where this crash was. And then after this whole thing was there, they built a landfill on it where this crash was. So there's no way of ever finding anything and connecting it to that crash, which makes me think whatever landed the way it was, either when they broke it apart or maybe it was more broken apart than what Selman realized from the distance he was at. So what better way to cover it up than go, okay, dig a hole right here and start throwing trash in it.
Yeah.
And nobody will ever dig through enough trash to find anything remains of any, you know, extraterrestrial anything if you build a landfill on it, which I never even thought about that, but that is a hell of an idea.
They always come up with a way to cover it up.
Yes.
They always do.
Yeah. Here's another interesting thing. All the dirt that was dug out for that landfill was used for a dam in that area. They used all that to build a dam. So now there's no way you're going to be digging on a dam to try to sift through all that.
Right, yeah.
It was the perfect layout of the whole thing, but we're going to jump forward a little bit. 1992. In November, in New York, Shirley, New York, there was a fella. He says it actually took place around 7 p.m., but there was a fella driving on Sunrise Highway, and he said there was a patch of trees separating Sunrise Highway from, you ready for this, Montauk Highway.
Mm.
Yeah. And he describes this, that he saw a craft that was tubular in shape, like a cigars, you know what I'm saying? And he said it had two large bright blue lights on each end, and a bright white light in the center. But he said that he noticed this, that the structure itself, the color, was very a dull metallic, like gray. So now we're getting right back into the exact same craft that we always see, except like what you and I talk about. Why's it got the lights on it, right? What's up with the lights on this whole thing? But he claims that he saw this object make a very sharp turn, cross across the highway, and then slam into the woods there at South Haven Park. And he said that when it hit the ground, that there was a white beam, like a dazzlingly white beam of light. They said it turned night to day in a flash, like a large camera flash when it hit. So it was a beam of light shot up, boom, you know, which sounds almost kind of like a power source shutting down, you know, yeah, like an exploding battery. Now, this fella said that he came back to backtrack in that area so he could find the crash. He said by the time he exited and started coming back, there were already helicopters in that area. But he said that neither the helicopters or the personnel came in there to block off that part. And he said where they were at, none of them had anything. Said the men were all dressed in black, I'm assuming like fatigues, and the vehicles there had no markings whatsoever. There was nothing on them. So it goes back into the black helicopters, the black Suburbans, the black trucks, guys, you know, where it's just, that's it. Which also always makes you feel, you get that feeling of a military presence or a security presence when they're wearing all black style fatigues and all.
Yeah.
So you know that you really don't cross that, but then there's no way of ever going, man, I know who that was. That dude worked for New Jersey, or that dude worked for, you know, you've got that still that dividing line to where you're totally anonymous, but you still are imposing when they see you. So he says that he actually went west on another little road there, turned around and come back. And he said, there's a street. And he said the neighbors started reporting that they were having on the street he turned on to try to get back out to see if he could see it some more. The people in that area come out and was talking. He said they were having all kinds of electrical problems. He said phones would start ringing. Nobody was there. There was no television signal. It was all staticky. He said that you could still see a huge fire back in the woods flashing and going, almost like an electrical fire. Well, he goes on to say that at the same time all this was going on, there was someone driving east, and he said they saw an oval object fly over the town dump back over there, and it was coming down too. And he said that, of course, as I said, as it was leaving, as this thing was going, there was a green trail of something that it was emitting. They don't know if it was like some sort of energy or if it was like a green contrail or what it had as it was leaving. Now, what they don't know is if it was part of the crash on its trajectory or not. They don't know if this was the same craft,
right,
a different craft, what was really going on when they saw all this. But they did say that it was oval, and they believed that it may have been scouting the area. This is, you know, afterwards, the whole thing, to look for the one that crashed. They believe that it was circling around. Now, it goes on, of course, some people say that they know that the areas there at South Haven where the trees have been hit are actually bent and torn from the ground, and you can go there now and see where they're still bent to this day, like the way they grow and all this stuff,
right,
is all funky. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but it's something that would be easily to go and look. Now, there were some eyewitnesses said that there was a fire there, in addition to, of course, all the roads being blocked off. sounds to me like the police were using that as an excuse to keep people out. Oh, there was just a fire out here. You can't come in there. But they said the park was closed to the public for several days, 5 or 6 days after that. But after that park got shut down and they were still people investigating.
Yeah.
The people that lived around that park said that they were what they said was like power surges, like bump and then trip breakers, bump and trip breakers and stuff. And then they said their phones would still ring with nobody on them. You know, and we're talking no cell phones. We're talking right, landlines. Yeah. 92. We're talking landlines ringing. Nobody would be on the other end. People would go through it, talk about people were trying to get in there. They wanted to see what was going on. One guy said that he actually tried to get in there and look around because he was like, I wonder if it's, you know, what it is. You know, I'm just going to try to slip in the back way. There were people waiting for him, military helicopters. There were already people. So they had a full perimeter set around this whole thing. Here's what's wild. If you go and dig into this, they say that people online have already found records showing that the park itself was closed from November 25th. Now, mind you, it crashed the 24th. I'm sorry. It was closed from the 25th to the 28th. And it says this. The park says the reason it was closed to the general public was because it was reserved for some duck hunting. So I guess you can get your license to duck hunt and stuff in that area. It says, although that there were some local fire departments that were called to the area during the crash,
yeah,
they got sent back when they got there. That it was handled by the National Laboratory Fire Department of Brookhaven. It was a federally controlled fire department.
That's a little weird.
That's very weird. So if that's legit, you ought to be able to find paperwork on that. You ought to be able to FOIA that, or you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Go and look. There ought to be some sort of something going in there. There were some investigators got in there after it was all closed and they were allowed back in. They said, of course, they went there. They found the burnt trees. They found where it looked like something had been, they said, plowed and smooth. So it had been like covered up and drug out and tried to make look right by machinery. Mm-hmm. So whatever crashed, they dug out, did whatever they think that they did. They said that they got a higher than normal radiation readings in that area, these investigators that went in there. And they said, of course, higher than normal backline. But they said, here's the strange thing. There was no magnetic reading in that area. None whatsoever.
Mm.
So you get out, you can get some magnetic, you get there, nothing. Now it says it's explained that there's some metal fences that maintain magnetic charge, of course, from the earth there. And something in that area had stripped it all away. So there was like, whatever had crashed had taken all the magnetic power from everything around there. So they're believing that that actually is what helped, I guess you could say, cause some of these power surges.
Yeah, right.
Things like that. Throw things out of whack. Phone lines out of whack. Television signals out of whack. Everything because...
I've never heard of this case.
And it's strange. It's a very strange thing.
1992.
In
Long
New
Island,
York,
right?
In New York, yeah. Now, they say that, of course, that there is some other... Well, we get into these photos, right? That this... People see these different photos. They see this gas. They see this white clouds coming up out of the woods. There's a lot of all this other stuff. But I think it's very strange, of course, that it's not one person that saw it all. There's these different tales that have come in from different people. Now, this could easily be a hoax, every bit of this. Or it could have been real, and then now there's so much disinformation, they're trying to cover this whole thing up. They say there's some pictures out there, though, of what shows a person trying to lift a body near a tree. And they said, you really can't tell it, but some people, but it looks like they're dragging bodies away from this crash site. So it could have easily been, you know, something that's earthly, just a crash in there, and then that's all it was. They just don't want to know anybody know what they're working on. But there is other witnesses saying that they had seen some unusual objects around that exact same time started coming forward. They're like, man, when I was there, I saw the same thing. I'm driving down this other road where it crashed. I see the same thing. I pull over. I watch this thing crash into the ground. I see this light beam shoot up into the sky. Everything turns bright, turns to day. Pretty much the exact same thing that the fella talked about at the very beginning was backed up by other people. Other people started coming forward talking about what they saw. It's insane. That it's almost like this is too big to hide, but they're still hiding. I'd never heard of this till I went to pull, and it just popped up, and I'm like, what is this? It's too big. And it's these people are even coming into where there was a young mother said she had her children with her and that they would not let her travel where she had to go. They turned her around, sent her back, had to go around, and they kept using for the fact of a fire. We've got to keep this fire under control, this fire. And all the people that were standing around are like, dude, we saw something crash in there. What crashed? Like, nothing crashed, man. It was just a fire. A fire. That's it. That's all. So you're kind of like,
well, right.
Well, then it always makes me go, well, was it a fire? Was it maybe a, you know.
A meteorite.
But even if it was a meteorite, you would think that if it was big enough to cause a fire, it'd big enough to level some trees. I'm talking about the size that we already have reported on over Chelyabinsk, things like that. If it would have been big enough to cause a fire when it hit the ground, it would have leveled the trees in that area.
I have no idea. I mean, what if it was only the size of a baseball, but it was burning hot?
Well, hot, but then you would think it would bury up if it hit going that fast.
Yeah, I have
no idea. I don't know. But it does sound like people saw something. And then here's another thing. If it's a meteorite, why is everybody out there in unmarked vehicles and black fatigues?
Right. It wouldn't explain the light shooting up. It wouldn't explain all the magnetic problems they're having in the area, phone lines, things like that, power surges.
So we're going to get into a real strange one here to wrap this little jewel up. Like all those weren't strange enough. Why don't you get a load of this? This comes from South Africa in 1989 in the Kalahari. There was a naval frigate radioed the Cape Town Naval Headquarters at 1:45 p.m. to report that they had seen a UFO on their radar and that it was heading towards the African continent in a northwesterly direction. And that they, on the frigate, had estimated that they believed that this, whatever it was, this UFO, was traveling around 6,600 miles an hour.
Wow.
So almost sounds like a meteor burning in, right? Yeah. That's what it sounds like. So the Naval Headquarters acknowledges this. They're like, okay, we've got it. We've got it in lock. We're going to start watching it. It enters into South African airspace around 1:52 when it hits there. Boom. They see it. The people there in South Africa start trying to make radio contact with it. They start like, you know, hey, look, what's going on? What's this? What are you doing? What is it? Nothing. No response. So there's an Air Force base there called Valhalla. It was notified, and they sent up two fighter jets. Boom. Send them after this thing. The jets get airborne, turn and get into the track. This thing changes direction at that speed.
Whoa.
It doesn't, no slowing down. It just goes boom, and then it just ducks off to the left. Pew. So there's no way that it's ours.
It's a meteor.
Exactly. You're like, wait a second. It's not a meteor. It doesn't do that.
It's intelligently controlled.
And the human body can't withstand that.
So the G-forces,
like, yeah. We're like, what just happened here? Now, mind you, this was at 1:52. They received it, scrambled jets. At 1:59, the leader of that jet squadron says that he has visual confirmation and radar confirmation of this object. And they said that they gave him the order to fire on this aircraft. And he said that, now this is it. To arm and fire this, there was an experimental aircraft weapon that was this laser cannon, it says, that was on this plane.
And this was 1989?
This is 1989.
So this was Iceman and Slider,
this
probably,
is exactly
right?
What it is. Yeah, exactly. This is, Goose and Mavericks is wingman.
The Goose is already dead.
Yeah, don't bring that up. Come on. Well, apparently the squadron leader said that he had blinding flashes come from the object. Like it was like this. Like it started waving. He said, while it was moving. So it's like a shimmer. So you see a shimmer on this thing, and then it's these flashes of light coming out of this craft as he's hauling butt behind it, right?
Yeah.
He said it started decreasing in altitude. So this at 202, he says this thing starts dropping a rate down. So it starts falling down as it starts slowing down. He said then at great speed, this is what he reports, it dived. So he said it's still moving. It's dropping down. It gets down to a certain level, and then it turns and just shoots down towards the ground. And he said, and hits the desert 50 miles north of the South African border. So it's like he was
a kamikaze.
Well, the way he says it, he fired whatever weapon, this, you know, in air quotes, experimental weapon, was said to be mounted on this plane that they're flying, right?
Right.
This laser. And he said, you know, he fires it. It starts doing all this pulsing. Maybe it was nothing more, you know, who knows? Who knows what this laser did, if it was even really a laser. Maybe they shot rockets at it. I don't have any idea. But that's when it pulsed, and he said that's when it went to doing it. And then when it shifted, he said it just dropped down, you know, over 20-degree angle, and then it just shot into the ground. Like it lost complete control, but it still had power. You know, like
right.
It's not responsive. Boom, this thing slams into the ground. So, of course, he tells them, hey, look, this thing hit the ground. We're out in the desert there in the Kalahari. What do? They said, circle this area. And it says, just stay there until we get some people on scene. So these guys have to, in their jets, they're circling this whole thing, just keeping an eye on it. Well, so they scramble a bunch of officers together. They got some medical staff, all this stuff together, load them up, and they shoot them out that way. The story goes that there was a magazine called Quest International, and that they had actually done some reporting on this, and that they had said that they had found some information on a South African Air Force and United States Air Force joint operation, and they say that this joint operation was dubbed Operation Silver Diamond, and that what they were going to do was going to recover debris and possible occupants of this craft. Now, they say in this report that there was a lieutenant colonel from the United States Air Force that was quoted telling that one of his informants, all right, one of his informants that had talked to him or whatnot, said that the UFO would be exchanged for advanced technology and it would be given to the South African government. So the U.S. would show up and get it, and it would in turn go, okay, you let us have it. We're going to give you part of the treasure, is kind of what they were working towards. Now, they say that the physical evidence of this craft and this whole crash was from some photocopied pictures. And, of course, these photocopied pictures were done from a satellite array on Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Of course.
Yeah, of course, right. Now, and all it says is that they could confirm. Now, I don't know if you could FOIA this or whatnot, but the story goes that it confirmed, like, what they said, what they, you know, would release to the press, I'm assuming, was a satellite burned in. Satellite hit the ground. That's all it was.
Right.
You know, and that makes, you know, some truth. But you got to imagine this. There was a couple of ufologists. There was a couple of ufologists, one, a German and American ufologist, and they went to researching this. And there was a man named Dr. Hertak. And anyway, he goes in and they start looking into this, and they both come to the conclusion that there was indeed a crash in the Kalahari Desert, what they could dig up, what it was. Apparently, there was a Botswana's environmental minister released in a report in 93 confirming that there was a crash of something in the desert there. But in this report, it apparently brings up that this alleged cover-up was disinformation and that it was just, you know, coming with from the U.S. and from South Africa's government. So anybody trying to uncover what really went on there was just compounded with a lot of disinfo. So we don't really know exactly, you know, if what we're getting and what we're reading and what we're seeing is, was it a satellite crash? Or my thing is this, if it's a lot of disinformation and that was already released in a report where somebody had messed up and said that's what they were doing, they FOIA'd it out of the South Africa government or whatever, then why would you go to all this trouble to release a crash satellite?
Right.
You know, disinfo this whole entire crash satellite. So the story says, of course, it talks about the fighter jets. It talks about all of this stuff going down. It talks about what they had seen, all of these things. Now, there's some stuff that come out that you can't really verify in any way. So we don't know if this was disinformation or not. But here's some of the parts of the story that you can find. You can find this, that they say that this object was silver and colored, and it was embedded in the side of a crater. So it had bounced and then stuck in the side of the crater. They say that top to bottom, this object was 40 foot tall and 500 foot in diameter.
Yeah, that's pretty big.
Yeah. They also say that they were around this object, there was intense heat when it had come screaming into the ground, of course, and that it had made glass, that the sand in that area had turned to glass. So it's like the blast glass that we talk about due to the intense heat. It goes on that also, yet again, there was intense, except instead of being minus in New York, there was in magnified magnetic readings in these areas around this object. And also it had magnified the radioactive parts. You know, the radioactivity in that area was heightened, and that electronic equipment wouldn't work around this craft. So everything seems to be, of course, like again, in disarray. They suspected that this craft was extraterrestrial. That's, you know, what they think. They don't think it was just due to, like we talked about, to the speeds, things like that. They don't know exactly where it came from. They said, of course, that where it hit the ground, there was nothing, like it hadn't just, there was nothing that you could tell where it was from, where it had hit the ground. You know what I'm saying? Right. It was just dirt, and that was about it. So anything out there, and also going back to try to find it again, to try to find this crash site after all these years and stuff, people are like, there's no way. It's just sand and a little, you know, loose soil. You're not going to be able to find this big crater where this thing actually, you know, rested. They also said that there was no insignias, no anything on the craft that they couldn't find. They believed it weighed around 55 tons is what they believed that this craft weighed. They don't know what it's made out of. They said the outside, of course, was smooth, looked like it had been hand-polished or polished with a machine.
Right.
They have no idea. They also don't have any clue on how it flew. They have no idea how it maintained any of that stuff. But part of the story says that when they finally got into the craft, that there were two humanoid-like creatures inside of it. Both of them, it says that they have no idea. You know, they're 4 to 4.5 feet, that what they describe looks exactly like a typical alien gray, no hair. everything oversized, you know, nothing. They said, you know, the prominent cheekbones, the large eyes, no pupils, the mouth. They said no lips, just that little slit. You know, we're talking about the little holes, just tiny little holes for the nose, no ears. I mean, everything they described was exactly like an alien gray. They even go down and talk about the torso, its body, its hands, three fingers. I mean, it is to the T of what it is. But what the one thing that they do describe is this. They weren't dead.
Oh, yeah?
It says they were extremely aggressive when they got them in there. So I guess they were in there. I don't know if they were hurt or hiding or what it is. The story says that they got them in there and that one of the doctors was trying to take some samples, and I guess they had it strapped down and ended up attacking him, scratched him with those big fingers and all this stuff. But they said that it wouldn't eat. Now, part of the story still goes that they were suspected to be telepathic. They tried, and of course, this all that stuff, they had them at apparently some Air Force base in that area, but of course, later on, they were taken to Wright-Patterson.
Of course.
Is where they were hauled off to. Now, like I said, you can take it for what it is. You can't really find anything definitive on what is exactly was found there. You can find out some stuff about, you know, people say that they've got information on that there were helicopters dispatched to that area, that there were crew members have talked about being dispatched to that area. There's a lot of stuff, though, that have really been, I guess, unfounded. If you will, there's a lot of this story that all seems it's a crazy story. It seems to be full of, like most, full of conjecture, full of a lot of dead ends, if you will. The interesting part of it is that later on, they said, while on the inside of this craft, that they found what was said to be an alien alphabet on the inside of this craft. And the way it was described sounds a lot like whenever they were describing the beams of writing that they had found at Roswell on this alleged craft. You know
right,
what I'm saying?
I know what
there?
You're saying, yeah. It's almost like hieroglyphics.
Yeah.
Emojis.
And the story goes that they had people studying it over there, of course, at Wright-Patterson and all this. Now, look, I don't know if any of this story is true. I have no idea. I don't know if any of it's, you know, not true. It may all be true. Every bit of this stuff may be true. I don't know how you could not keep this secret. This seems to be like it would be too easy of a secret to keep if it had crashed in South Africa. It'd be something, it seems like it would be easier to control that part of the government or somebody else's government than our own if one had landed, like, say, in New York the way it was
right there,
especially if it was this wacky, this crazy of a really wild tale. But the reason that I bring this whole thing up in itself, the way this story is because of the way it seems to be so much like the Roswell crash. It almost seems like they've built this disinformation story out of what we knew happened at Roswell and just stuck it in South Africa. But also it makes me wonder, part of me wants to say this whole thing is a joke. That, you know, not all the stories we've covered, just this one. This one, part of me wants to go, look, it's 1989. Much like the 1992 one. I'm like, come on, man. We know more than that now. We're smarter than we were in the 40s and the 50s. Come on. But then part of me wants to go, or is the reason that none of us have heard of this, or only some of us have heard of this, is because they do a good job of covering it up. Maybe it is real. Maybe the ones that are more well known, maybe those are meant to be put out to be more well known. I don't know. I'm so torn with this.
I don't know.
Because, like we said, some of them sound like they're humans.
How many of them are unreported?
Exactly. Some of these sound like they're human. Some of these sound like they're, you know, the Nordics. But a lot of these are these grays. You start getting into these grays. Well, what if we made the grays?
Right.
What if it's not, you know, extraterrestrial? What if they're clones that we've built? What if it's stuff that we've built because we physically can't survive and these things are built to test out our equipment? And if they crash land, we're not out nothing. We built them in a lab. So it could easily be something that we ourselves not only have constructed this space equipment,
yeah,
but we've also constructed the occupants to fly those things too. And that's all they know. They don't have to eat much. And if you lose them, they're just like, eh. Well, they're not real people to start with.
Right.
So
yeah, I don't know. It's crazy.
I don't have any idea. So folks, I hope you enjoyed the madness that was these crazy crashes. I hope I didn't lead you down too much of a rabbit hole. Just give you something to think about, something else to look up. It was fun to discuss them, and we changed it up a little bit this time, but we will come back after the break. We'll wrap this little dumpling up, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. I like it when you bring up these lesser-known UFO crashes or supposed
UFO. It's just fun crashes to discuss them.
It is very interesting. And like you were talking about, could these grays actually be something that we have created? We've built them. They're not from another planet. These UFOs are not from another planet either. This is all stuff that's man-made. But the public thinks that they're extraterrestrial. The public thinks that these are beings from another dimension or another galaxy far, far away. What if it's not? And if you're interested in things like that, I suggest you check out this. This is a new sponsor of ours, yeah. Gaia. Gaia, GAIA.com. It's pretty cool. This is a streaming service. They have over 7,000 different videos on there. It's kind of like Netflix.
Yes.
You can watch it. They got plans. They got monthly plans, a three-month plan, an annual plan. And they've got this new series on there that I've been watching, and it's very interesting. It's called Deep Space. And it's going to be, I don't know how many parts that there's going to be when it's finished, but so far there's already like seven separate episodes. And each episode is like an hour to an hour and a half long. And they're very interesting, and that's exactly what they're talking about. They're talking about how the UFO phenomenon has been recorded through ancient artworks, ancient literature, mm-hmm. ancient architecture. They've been here. Their presence on Earth has been a long-term thing. This is not here. And that governments of the world have been covering up this stuff, whether it's NASA imagery, ancient artworks, ancient structures. The world governments have been covering this presence up, and it's pretty neat. There's several episodes on it. One of them is Rise of Artificial Intelligence.
That's the newest one.
One yeah. is Inside the Program. One is Covert Colonization of Space.
I like Secrets of Anti-Gravity.
Secrets of Anti-Gravity. I like that one. And there's a brand new one that just came out called Aliens and Cover-Ups. Let's listen. Let's give a listen to this.
In 1960, a think tank called Brookings Institution came out with a special report in which they had gone in and investigated the question of disclosure and the widespread revealing of the existence of intelligent extraterrestrial civilizations visiting the Earth. Based on certain classic memes, such as the infamous 1939 War of the Worlds radio broadcast hosted by Orson Welles, in which allegedly people thought they were being invaded by Martians, people started stuffing wet towels up their chimney, they started freaking out, believing the world was over. This and other events made the Brookings Institution conclude that they could not tell us the truth because it would be a fatal blow against the stability of civilization as we know it.
Rumors that there was a close encounter with aliens at Holloman Air Force Base have been swirling since at least the 1970s. There is even a supposed film of the flying saucer landing.
There was an alleged contact between extraterrestrials and the U.S. military industrial complex that took place at the Holloman Air Force Base. This appears to be one of several such contacts, but what is interesting about this one in particular is that these groups of extraterrestrials seem to have a very elaborate headdress that was on, as well as unusual faces that were kind of very small and tapered with a pronounced nasal feature. These extraterrestrials, like many of the others, did apparently want peace. They were trying to negotiate some sort of positive settlement for Earth's problems, but as is the case, they want disarmament of nuclear weapons, they want the truth to be told to the people, and the military industrial complex and the government officials just laughed in their faces.
So there you go. Very interesting. And like I said, this isn't the only thing. There's several other series on this network, documentaries. If you're a big fan of ancient aliens and things like that, mm-hmm. man, you might need to go over there and check this out. And not only that, if you're not into these hidden truths and things like that, there's other things on this channel. They have lots of yoga, spiritualism, meditation, things like that. It's a really neat service, and if you're interested in that type of thing, you might want to go check it out. It's Gaia.com, G-A-I-A.com. Cam, what do you got going on this week, brother?
Not much. I'm kind of getting back into the normal grind, and we're getting everything wound up to get ready for Halloween around my house.
Man, it's coming up, right? And it's always a fun time with the kids, of course. Now, Luke has changed his costume probably 4 times already.
Uh-oh.
In the beginning, he was going to be a Ninja Turtle.
Yeah.
We bought him the Ninja Turtle outfit. You know, we thought, hey. We're good to go. Well, let's get it done now. Since then, he's changed his mind. He wanted to be Iron Man. So then we went and bought an Iron Man costume. Good to go.
He was wearing that when I got here this morning.
Right. Well, he's already talking about changing again. He still likes the Iron Man outfit that you saw him in.
Yeah.
But that's not what he's going to be for Halloween.
Oh, what's he going to do now?
He wants to be a zombie now.
Okay.
So who knows what he's going to be by the time the date gets here? I have no idea. But he's got numerous costumes anyways.
Yeah.
You know, kids, they like to dress up in these things. So as far as what the older twins are going to be for Halloween, I have no idea. But it'll be interesting to see what they finally choose. I'll try to take some pictures and Instagram that stuff, right? So what do you got going on for the rest of the week, brother?
Man, same old. I'm getting back into the groove. Just, like I said, getting prepped, getting everything ready to go. And that's pretty much it, man. I don't have anything going. I'm getting more and more consumed with photography, man. I'm really getting to where I enjoy it. I'm monkeying around. It's something new to learn. You know what I mean? And it seems to be
cool.
Endless. And it was one of those things. I listened to an interview on Joe Rogan's podcast with a bow hunter named Adam Greentree. And went and looked at some of the photos that he had taken whenever he's out camping and hiking and doing all that. And that was just one of those deals that kind of made me want to get back involved in being outdoors and just taking pictures. So I was like, you know what? I like that. I love going camping. I love going out there, but the photography thing is getting to be fun. So I think I'm fixing to be like a camera hunter. That's what I'm fixing
to
turn into. Yeah.
Yeah. Real quick before we get out of here. For those people that are not elite members,
oh, yeah.
I would like you to bring up like what's going on with Unusual Encounters.
Yeah, let me lay that on y'all, folks. Okay, we haven't forgot about it. What it is I've overwhelmed the computer systems that I actually have for my editing. We've been building some videos and building stuff like that, and it's just overwhelmed it. It's too much.
We've captured several episodes of Unusual Encounters with our cameras. The problem is, in attempting to bring the highest quality of video, we're talking like 4K or something like that. What we didn't realize is rendering that video can be a chore if your computer's not set up for doing something like that. So Cam has been trying to render these videos. And of course, we use top-end software is the word I'm looking for. We use Adobe Premiere and After Effects and things like that. But even with that, how long did you say like...
Oh,
a 15-minute episode was taking like 30 hours to render?
Yeah, I mean, 15 to 30-minute episode is going to take me, you know, 30 hours to render out. And I'm like, look, I'm not going to keep doing this. No. So Kyle contacted his friends over at MIT, like we said, and then the JPL, and they're building us a computer.
We're
getting a supercomputer built to put together some videos. So bear with me a little bit longer. Once we get all that done, we'll be able to start releasing them on a more timely fashion, where I can knock them out instead of me trying to put one together and then wait forever. It's like I would be better off if I just cut them and did it myself by hand.
Yeah, so they'll be out as soon as we get our supercomputer here to render those. If you'd like to share a story with Expanded Perspectives, don't forget you can email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can also call the show 817-945-3828. And please, if you haven't done so already, go to iTunes and write us a review. We're almost at 400 here in the U.S., be really awesome to break that mark. Everybody out there, please have a good week. Don't work too hard and stay safe. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Folks, take care in Florida. Peace, y'all.